Thankful to be together again this afternoon and appreciate each of you very much for being here. As Barry said this morning, we're going to finish our study with the book of Malachi, which will finish our planned series on the minor prophets. There's only one that we haven't covered yet, and that's the book of Zechariah. And the material that I have on Zechariah is planned around an 8-sermon series, so it's got to be completely revamped to fit into the format we've been doing on this. So I'll just table that to do for another day, and tonight we'll call it done for a while on our study of the minor prophets. I want to say a word to you about this. I really appreciate your interest in these studies. I set a goal many, many years ago to dig into them more and learn more about them, and some of the information is built a lot around history, and some of it's a little bit technical in nature as you talk about the specifics of the prophecies and what they were all about. And I realize that kind of material can get to be dry to people. Even if you're interested in knowing more about it, it can kind of be dry in nature. We've tried to avoid that some, and you've done your part in maintaining a good interest in it. And I really appreciate that, because the message of these prophets, as you know, are very important. To refresh you a little bit on where we're at with Malachi, just on where we believe he falls in line with regard to the rest of the prophets, you might recall that in his book he mentions the priests, the altar, the table of the Lord, all that as being in place and functional. In chapter 3, he talks about the Lord's house there, or the temple, as though it had been completed in its reconstruction. So this gives us the idea that Malachi had come along at a time in history that was after when the temple had been rebuilt. And after the Babylonian captivity, there was a certain window of time there where they believed that that work had been completed. And when you look a little closer to Malachi, we find out that a lot of what he says compares in circumstances with the latter part of Nehemiah's life. And the latter part of Nehemiah's life, we're told when that was the 32nd year of the reign of Artaxerxes, who was the Persian king over the region of Babylon there. And when we place that in history, the reign of Artaxerxes would be here. So you get to the 32nd year of his reign, that would have Malachi starting along somewhere around 420 B.C. Some scholars place him closer to 400 B.C. That gives you a rough idea of when he would prophesy. And this satisfies all the demands. It has him coming along after the temple was complete and worship was fully in place, and has him coming along at a time congruent with the tail end of Nehemiah's life. So he's regarded as the final prophet of the Old Testament. And we speak sometimes of the 400 years of silence, or the 400 silent years. And if you ever hear somebody talk about this, here's what they're talking about. Malachi was about 400 years before Christ. He was the last prophet. After him, there were no more until John the Baptist came along. What's interesting is, even from the Jewish perspective, the Orthodox Jewish teachers today believe that Malachi was the last prophet. And, of course, they don't believe that John or Jesus were prophets in the same sense that we do, men of God, and of course Jesus the Son of God, but it's generally believed that Malachi represents the appropriate end of the Old Testament. His work deals with the nation of Judah, and particularly the capital city of Jerusalem, at a time when they were sort of answering to Persian authority, although they had a degree of independence. They were within the framework of the Persian Empire, so those locations on the map sort of helps you understand we're dealing with a nation that's basically where Iran is today, and Judah over there along the area of the Middle East. Now let's get into chapter 3, which is where we left off in Malachi's book, and start at verse 1. He said, "Behold, I will send my messenger, and he shall prepare the way before me, and the Lord whom ye seek shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant whom ye delight in. Behold, he shall come, saith the Lord of hosts." Now let's think about this for just a moment. He tells us that the messenger is going to come to prepare the way of the Lord. Now you might recall from our first study in the book of Malachi that Malachi's name means messenger. In fact, there's some believe that that's actually not the prophet's name. It's just a symbolic appellation to indicate his role as a messenger. Well, whether or not that was really his name or just a symbolic title, either way, his name, Malachi, means a messenger. And as a messenger, He was foretelling the coming of this messenger, who was, we'll find out, John the Baptist, who was to prepare the way for the coming of the Lord, Jesus Christ, who is the messenger of the covenant. So it's interesting, we have the last prophet of the Old Testament as a messenger saying the next messenger that comes, the next prophet of God, will be the one who announces the coming of the Son of God, who will be the messenger of the covenant. Now, why would he talk about the messenger of the covenant? God already had his covenant with Israel. He already had that was given there at Mount Sinai through Moses. Why would he talk about the Messiah being the messenger of the covenant? Well, if you study much Christology in the Old Testament or much teaching about the Messiah, you quickly learn that it was anticipated that when the Messiah would come, he would bring a new covenant. Jeremiah 31 is the most ready example of that for our way of thinking, because he's quoted in the book of Hebrews as foretelling, "Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I'll bring this new covenant, and it shall come to pass in the last days," I believe is the way that it's actually put, that there would come this new covenant. "I'll make a new covenant with the house of Israel, the house of Judah, and it'll not be like the old covenant that I made with their fathers when I brought them out of the land of Egypt there up to Mount Sinai." And he goes on and explains that new covenant. And the Hebrew writer takes that anticipation up and says, you know, when he talks about that, there coming a new covenant in Jeremiah's day, he's saying that first covenant was becoming old and it was getting ready to vanish away. Well, Jeremiah was a couple hundred years, 150 years before Malachi. And in his day, that Mosaic covenant was getting old and getting ready to vanish away. And Malachi, the last prophet of the Old Testament, picks up that covenant notion and says, when this Messiah comes, he's going to be the messenger of this new covenant. So it makes sense with the rest of what the Old Testament says about Messiah's work, is that he would bring this new covenant. Now notice this passage is quoted in Matthew's Gospel in Matthew 11 and verse 10. Says that this is he of whom it is written, "Behold, I send my messenger before thy face, which shall prepare the way before thee." So this is quoting Malachi saying that, in talking about John the Baptist here in Matthew chapter 11. So Malachi 3 is about John the Baptist coming and preaching as a preparatory ministry for the coming of Christ. And this is consistent with what's foretold about him in the book of Isaiah chapter 40. He says that there'll be the coming of a voice crying in the wilderness, preparing the way of the Lord, making straight in the desert a highway for our God. And so this is also consistent with other parts of Old Testament teaching that puts together this detailed picture of what kind of things would happen when the Messiah would come. There would be this preparatory messenger who would preach in preparation of his coming. The Messiah would bring this covenant, and there's certainly a whole lot more. He also said that the Messiah would come to his temple there. He said, "He shall suddenly come to his temple." Now think of that rebuilt temple there at Jerusalem. And he said, the Messiah is going to come to this temple. Now let's go back real quick to a prophecy that's made in Daniel 9 and 26 about the Messiah. This could get kind of complicated. I don't want to spend too much time on it. I want to just give a brief overview of Daniel's prophecy here in Daniel 9 and 26. He said, "After 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself, and the people of the prince shall come and shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with the flood, and unto the end of the war desolations are determined." Now this section in Daniel foretells a lot of different things. He foretells the coming of the Messiah. He foretells the Messiah being put to death or being cut off. That word "cut off" there means put to death. He foretells the temple being destroyed. He says the people of the prince will destroy the city and the sanctuary. That's the temple. And of course, the city of Jerusalem itself, he says it will be destroyed. So there's a lot talked about here in this context in Daniel 9. Now I want to put it real quick on a chart. There's tons of questions about Daniel 9 that I won't have time to answer tonight. I want to give you a brief overview in order to tie it back with something that Malachi said. Daniel 9 gives a prophecy that starts counting from the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem and the temple, the streets and the city and the walls and all that. And when you dig through history and look at the particulars that Daniel calls for, to make a long story short, that refers to a decree that we find made in 457 B.C. And he's saying that 70 weeks or 77s are determined upon the people and upon the holy city. Well, again, long story short, without going into a lot of detailed explanation as to why, that refers to a 490-year period. And he said after 62 of these weeks or sevens or 483 years, then the Messiah would come and all these other things would happen. Well, what that looks at is that looks at the coming of the Messiah of the Prince there in 26 AD when you count that time forward, which is when Christ began his personal ministry. And he talks about the Messiah being cut off in the midst of that last period of 7 years. Well, he died 3.5 years after he began his ministry. That's what most calculations bring it to. And then he said at some point after that, he doesn't say exactly when, just at some point after that, the people of the prince would come and destroy the city with the temple. So whatever else Daniel is talking about, he talks about the coming of Messiah's ministry, and he talks about the destruction of the temple that would follow. Now let's marry this with what Malachi said. Malachi said the messenger would come and preach in preparation of the coming of the Messiah. The Messiah, this messenger of the covenant, would come and he would preach this new covenant. And he would come to his temple. Now you blend that with Daniel. Daniel says the Messiah is going to come. He's going to be killed. And sometime after that, the temple is going to be destroyed. Well, when you blend these two together, you get a very clear idea. And it is as follows. Whoever the Messiah is of the Old Testament, whether it's Jesus of Nazareth or somebody totally different, it had to be somebody before 70 AD. It couldn't be anybody since then. So if you're a faithful Orthodox Jew who believes in the prophecies of the Old Testament and you look at Jesus and say, nope, he's not the Christ, I reject him, fine. Who is the Messiah? It couldn't be anybody yet to come, because whoever the Messiah was, he was to come to his temple. Remember Malachi the prophet, they're preaching in the time of that rebuilt, restored temple, said he's coming here, people. He's going to come to this temple. And Daniel joins him and says, yes, he's coming. And after he is put to death, this temple's going to be destroyed. Well, it's been destroyed and it still hasn't been rebuilt. That was 2,000 years ago almost. So who is he if he's not Jesus of Nazareth? Who else walked on water? Who else raised the dead? Who else restored sight to the blind? Who else did so many miracles that it even turned the heads of the rulers of Israel? It couldn't be anybody but Jesus. So what we really have in this 1-2 combination between Malachi and Daniel is we have insurmountable evidence that says Jesus had to be the Messiah. If you look at it exclusively from a Jewish perspective, believing only the Jewish prophets, it had to be Jesus. There's no one else in Jewish history from 70 AD backwards that it could have been. Now going back to Malachi 3 and verse 1, we want to notice this idea of him coming to his temple. Listen to the way Haggai prophesied. And Haggai was just a few years prior to Malachi. He said, I will shake all the nations, and the desire of all nations shall come, and I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts. So what has happened here? Haggai the prophet said something similar to what Malachi said. He said that God would bring the desire of all nations. Well, what do all nations desire? Man has consistently desired the same thing ever since the fall in the garden. Relief from our guilt and a remedy for death. Every civilization of man has sought a way to get rid of our guilt and overcome death. And we still want that. And so God says, I'm going to bring the desire of all nations. That's relief from guilt, the remedy from death. That's Christ. And what's going to happen? When he would bring Christ, he would fill the temple with glory. What glory do you think would fill the temple? Gold? Somebody says, well, that's when Herod the Great come in and rebuilt and restructured and made the temple really nice. So gold is filling it with glory. Wisdom is more precious than gold. One sermon, one wise sermon would be more glory than all the gold that Herod used to decorate the temple. What greater glory would fill the temple than when the messenger of the covenant that Malachi foretold came and stood there and preached the wonderful words of life? That's the glory that Haggai foretold would come and fill the temple. Well, now notice, he said, I will fill this house. That's that temple, the second temple, the one that was rebuilt after the fall of Babylon. So we can't go and look at all these prophecies about the Messiah coming to the temple saying, well, that'll be a rebuilt third temple. That's what some Jews say. It won't work. Because Haggai, the Jewish prophet, said, no, it's going to be this temple. Well, the temple Haggai was talking about is long gone. The Romans destroyed it in 70 AD when they burned the whole city. It had to be Jesus. There's no one else in Jewish history that even come close to fitting the description. Now let's move along into Malachi chapter 3, verse 2 and 3. He said, who may abide the day of his coming? And who shall stand when he appeareth? For he is like a refiner's fire, like fuller's soap. And he shall sit as a refiner and a purifier of silver. And he shall purify the sons of Levi and purge them as gold and silver, that he may offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness. You think of this as a description of John's ministry, followed by the ministry of Christ. And I will tell you, that's a refiner's fire. Because when John came with his fiery preaching, he separated out the people of Israel who were willing to listen to God and the people that weren't. There were a lot of people that rejected what John preached, but a lot of people responded to what John preached. That was refiner's fire. That was taking this mass that had some precious things and some that was just trash, and it was burning it, you see, the way they would refine precious metals like silver or gold. Heat it up and burn it. And what would happen? It would burn out all the impurities. And what you had left was the pure precious metal. Well, that's what John's preaching did to the people of Israel. It separated all those ones out who rejected God. It burned out the impurities. And it left those who were willing to hear and willing to repent, willing to obey. And that's the ones that Christ picked up with his ministry of preaching, is the ones that John had converted. And so this is described as a coming of a judgment. He said, I will come near to you to judgment, and I will be a swift witness against the sorcerers and against the adulterers and against false swearers and against those that oppress the hireling his wages, the widow and the fatherless, that turn aside the stranger from his right and fear not me, saith the Lord of hosts, for I am the Lord, I change not. Therefore, you sons of Jacob are not consumed. Here he picks up that same thing we've talked about so many times. Their moral corruption, he says, he's going to come and he's going to judge it. Well, you go read about John's preaching, and he did exactly that. You generation of vipers. He said, you know, how shall you escape the fires of hell? And on he went. We don't have a lot of information about his preaching, but what little we have, we know it was a call to repentance. In fact, Jesus said his baptism was a baptism of repentance. John was calling upon the people of Israel to change, just like the prophet said he would do. And God says, I have always been this way. I've always had these moral standards. I'm the same. I'm unchanging. He said, if I wasn't that way, I'd have destroyed you people a long time ago. But because God is unchanging, when he said, Israel's my people that I'll bring the Messiah to, then he had to not change. He had to fulfill that promise. And so the same part of God that says, you're my people, is also the part of God that says, I expect you to live by these standards. And the coming of John's preaching was just another prophet of God coming to call Israel back to God's side. Continuing now, in Malachi 3 and verse 8, he preached to them about their tithes. He said, will a man rob God? Yet ye have robbed me. But ye say, wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings. Ye are cursed with a curse, for ye have robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring ye all the tithes of the storehouse, that there may be meat in mine house. And prove me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. There's a lot for us to think on here. Number one, consider that the people of Judah that day were failing to tithe properly. And God said, you're robbing me. Well, how are we robbing you? In tithes and offerings. You go back and study the giving law and the tithing law in the book of Leviticus. God said, that tithe belongs to me. In one perspective, we think of giving back to God. And that's one good way to look at it. But from another perspective, what we're giving to God, he's already the rightful owner of it. We're just showing our willingness to give up our usage of it, aren't we? And these people were robbing from God by not giving God what was rightfully his. Could we do the same thing if we're stingy and selfish in our giving? I remember one time several years ago when I was in training and preaching. There was at a congregation, and the collection basket was going around. There was a big ruckus and a big noise. There was a lady that was getting money out and putting money in it. What she needed was change, you know, and it was a big rowdy deal, and there was some sort of a misconception there for a moment in the confusion that rather than putting money in the basket, she was taking money out. Well, let's take that was sort of just a misunderstanding there, and let's expand that into just imagine passing the basket around, and what frame of mind would you have to come to before you just look in there and say, I believe I'm just going to put that in my pocket? Well, any of us would feel awful about that, wouldn't we? The fact of it is, if we don't give generously as the Lord teaches us, that's exactly what we're doing. We're robbing God. And of course, we shouldn't be that way. Well, what about this statement where God said, if you give like you're supposed to, I'll open the windows of heaven and pour out more blessings than you can hold. Go ahead and try me. Well, does that mean that if I'll give generously that God will make me rich? A lot of people would have you believe that today. But there's something we have to understand about this. This promise was made within the context of that first covenant that was packed with physical promises. God had all along promised Israel, if you follow me, I will physically bless you as a nation. I'll make you wealthy. I'll make you prosperous. I'll make you powerful. I'll make you politically strong. I'll make your enemies bow to you. That was part of their covenant all along. So when God said, if you tithe properly, I will pour out blessings, that was nothing different than what had been promised to them way back in the law, back in Deuteronomy chapter 28. But the new covenant that the Messiah brought is not packed with all those physical promises. God didn't promise to bless us as a physical nation because God's people is no longer a physical nation. We're a spiritual entity, the church. And so consequently, all those physical blessings that attended that first covenant are not part of this new covenant. In fact, the Hebrew writer says that the covenant of Christ is a better covenant established upon better promises. Today, instead of saying, I'll make you a powerful nation for this window of your life on earth, God promised, I'll give you a home in heaven. You won't just rest in the land of Canaan for the duration of your nation. You'll rest in a heavenly Canaan or in a heavenly rest forever. That's what Hebrews chapter 4 is about. And so the idea is today we have this better covenant established on spiritual promises that are better promises. So we look at this promise of blessings here, and we don't think in terms of if I give generously to God, He'll bless me back in a physical way, may or may not. But I think of this in terms of what spiritual blessings I'll receive from God in exchange for what physical offering we might give. Then he talks about this book of remembrance in Malachi 3. After promising blessings, if they would give properly, he said, they that feared the Lord spake often one to another, and the Lord hearkened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the Lord and that thought upon his name. And they shall be mine, saith the Lord of hosts, in that day when I make up my jewels, and I will spare them as a man spareth his own son that serveth him. Then shall ye return and discern between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serveth God and him that serveth him not. This is the effect of John's preaching, that he would discern between those who would follow God and those who would not follow God. And what does he perceive here? He sees God's people talking to each other, encouraging one another. And God puts it down in his book of remembrance. He says, look at those people. They're thinking about me. They're talking about serving me. They're encouraging each other to do what's right. And God says, I'll spare these people my wrath. Well, you carry that into this new covenant era. You carry that into the days of John's preaching and into the ministry of Christ. And you carry it all right up to today. God sees us. He sees us encouraging one another. Think about this. It goes in his book of remembrance. Now, whether or not he has a literal book in heaven is not the point. The point is God takes note of it. God is not unrighteous to forget your work and labor of love, the Hebrew writer tells us. He takes note of the things that we do, and he promises to reward those that are righteous. Now, continuing into Malachi chapter 4, in chapter 4, he cycles back through some of the same things that are introduced in Malachi chapter 3, just discusses it in different terms. Consider Malachi 4 and verse 1. Behold, the days come that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yea, all that do wickedly, shall be stubble. And the day that cometh shall burn them up, saith the Lord of hosts. It shall leave them neither root nor branch. So here's the coming. This burning is depicted. It's a fiery wrath of God. In Zephaniah 1 and verse 18, look at the idea of burning there. He said, neither their silver nor their gold shall be able to deliver them in the day of the Lord's wrath, but the whole land shall be devoured by the fire of his jealousy. Do you suppose that fire of God's jealousy was a literal fire? Well, it sounds like just sort of a symbolic expression of his wrath. And here's the reason I'm pointing this out. There are some people that look at Malachi 4 and verse 1 as they say, that's the end of time. The wicked being burned up and annihilated. The Jehovah's Witness religious organization teaches that's the wicked being annihilated at the end of time. This is at the time of the messenger, John the Baptist. Stay tuned and you'll see that. It's not talking about the end of time. Furthermore, the burning here is more a symbolic burning. Just like we've got in Zephaniah chapter 1 and verse 18. This is God's wrath being poured out on his people as he separates out the good from the bad. And John's preaching did just that. And what happened to those that were evil, that rejected John's preaching, that rejected Jesus, the Son of God? Romans 11 will tell you what happened. They were cut off the vine. They were severed from God. Now, did God literally saw them with a saw? No. Did he literally burn them with a fire like here? No. Those are symbols of God's rejection, of God's wrath against those who were formerly his people. Malachi 4 verse 2 and 3, he says, unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings. And ye shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall, and ye shall tread down the wicked, for they shall be ashes under the soles of your feet in the day that I shall do this, saith the Lord of hosts. One time I was studying with some witnesses, and they brought this up about the wicked being burned up like stubble, and then when we're in paradise on earth, we're going to tread on their ashes. I said, well, if that's true and that fire is literal, then so are the calves, and God's going to turn us all into cows in paradise. Now, if that calves is symbolic of somebody growing and flourishing like a calf that's being finish fed, then so's the fire, you see. It's not consistent to try to say, well, this has to be taken literally, but then not be willing to take the whole thing literally. When we recognize that these prophets are sometimes, prophecies are written in symbolic language, that opens up the door for a more sensible explanation of these things that's more consistent with the context. So here we are seen as when the others are burned or rejected by God. On the other hand, you have some that are flourishing, and the Son of Righteousness arises up within them. What do you suppose that Son of Righteousness is? Those of you who are Bible students, you really like to dig a little, go back and dig through Balaam's prophecies. Well, I know you won't find the book of Balaam, but he's talked about in the book of Numbers. Dig through his prophecies and you'll find him foretelling the coming of the one that the New Testament refers to as the day star. 2 Peter 1 and verse 19 says, we have a more sure word of prophecy, whereunto you do well that ye take heed as unto a light that shineth in a dark place until the day dawn and the day star arise in your hearts. That day star is Jesus. And so what happens here in 2 Peter 1? As we follow Christ and we adhere to this more sure word of prophecy, we learn about him from the Old Testament, a prophetic expectation of him, and we read about how he fulfilled this, that's the day star rising in our heart. That day star is the sun. That's the Son of Righteousness arising. As we grow in our faith in Christ and we grow in our relationship with him, and what does he have? What does he have? He has healing in his wings. You remember this the next time you're crying. You remember this the next time you're hurting. You remember this the next time you're grieving something, you wonder if you're going to get over it or not. The deeper we grow in Christ, that day star, that Son of Righteousness, he just rises up inside us and he has healing in his wings. And that healing is a promise of eternal salvation, an eternal hope that we have as an anchor for our souls, the Bible tells us. That's quite a wonderful promise, isn't it? That Malachi foretells. Now, continuing deeper into Malachi 4, we have also this promise not only of the Messiah, but of the messenger. Just like chapter 3 foretold the messenger. But here it's put in different terms. He said, "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord." Now, some people look at this and say, this is a reincarnation of Elijah, the literal prophet Elijah from the Old Testament that comes just before the end of time. That's what this has to be. Well, we've studied in times past that the dreadful day of the Lord in the Old Testament, it's not always the end of time. There's a lot of times it's just God's judgment against a certain people. And we've already seen God's judgment against Israel as those who rejected His Son were rejected by Him and cut off from His people. Romans 11 teaches that those who rejected Christ were cut off. And He said, if He spared not the natural branches, He'll also not spare me and you. If we reject God or we turn against the Lord, He'll cut us off too. So that's the dreadful day of the Lord there is God's wrath against those who reject Him. So who is this Elijah the prophet? Matthew 16 and 14, in speculating here about who was Jesus, they said, some say thou art John the Baptist, some Elias, and others Jeremias, or one of the prophets. Elias is Elijah. Jeremias is Jeremiah. Those are just Greek pronunciations of those Hebrew names. So what was the speculation about Jesus? At some point in His ministry, the Jews, being familiar with Malachi's prophecy, looked at Jesus and said, maybe that's the Elijah that was foretold in Malachi 4 and verse 5. Now, I'm not saying they were right. Obviously, Jesus wasn't Elijah. I'm just telling you, they read that in Malachi 4, and they got this idea, somebody's coming that's going to be Elijah. Well, who was that to be? In John 1 and 21, here they are talking to John the Baptist, and they asked him, what then, art thou Elias? And he said, I'm not. Art thou that prophet? And he answered, no. Now let's take this to heart. Was John the Baptist literally Elijah the prophet reincarnated? No. The prophet was not intended to, the prophecy was not intended to be taken literally like that. What would he say? He would be Elijah. Read on. Luke 1 and verse 17. He shall go before him, talking about the ministry of John the Baptist, he shall go before him in the spirit and the power of Elijah, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. That's the preparatory ministry of John the Baptist, preparing the way for Christ. And he would come in the spirit and the power of Elijah, so he's symbolically called Elijah in the book of Malachi. In Matthew 17, look at verse 10 and hear what Jesus had to say about this passage. His disciples asked him, saying, why then say the scribes that Elias must first come? And Jesus answered and said unto them, Elias truly shall first come and restore all things. But I say unto you that Elias is come already, and they knew him not, but have done unto him whatsoever they listed. Likewise shall also the Son of Man suffer of them. Then the disciples understood that he spake unto them of John the Baptist. Then the disciples understood. What did they understand? Well, all these scribes, all these Jews were saying, well, Elijah's got to come. They're thinking Malachi 4 in verse 5. And Jesus said, they're right. He has to come to prepare the way for the Lord. In fact, he did come. Now, for those who would say, no, that's about the end of time. That's about literal Elijah being reincarnated to come at the end of time. Jesus said, no, he's already come. It's already been fulfilled. Was he literally Elijah? John said no. But what did Luke's gospel say? He came in the spirit and power of Elijah, you see. And so Elijah as a name was aptly symbolic of John's ministry because he came in the spirit and the power of Elijah with his fiery preaching, preaching to God's people that they must turn in order to avert God's wrath. And what did Elijah discover? There was only a remnant of Israel that didn't bow the knee to Baal. And what did the symbolic Elijah, John the Baptist, discover? There was only a remnant of Israel that would accept Jesus as the Son of God. The rest rejected him. Matthew 11, verse 13 and 14. All the prophets in the law prophesied until John. And if you will receive it, this is Elias, which was for to come. I just want to tell you, not everybody will receive it. If I could be real honest with you, premillennialists won't receive it. the ones that teach us left behind stuff. You know the books and the movies. If you're not acquainted with premillennialism, ask later and I'll explain it. I think a lot of you are acquainted with the whole rapture, thousand year reign doctrine. That any material I've ever read from them, they've always said, no, John was not Elijah that was foretold. Jesus said, if you'll receive it, yes, he is. The truth of it is, a lot of people won't receive it. The premillennialists won't receive it. The Jehovah's Witnesses won't receive it. They insist that's about the end of time. Jesus knew some people wouldn't receive it. You see, people are still rejecting Jesus today. I don't mean to sound unkind towards some of these beliefs, but look, we're either going to believe what Jesus said or we're not. Okay? And Jesus said of John, this is Elias. I believe him. And I believe that anybody else who accepts Christ as a man of God, as the Son of God, should also believe him. Notice this statement in Malachi 4 and verse 6 that he would turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to their fathers. This person that would come in the name of Elijah or in the spirit and power of Elijah preaching, his preaching would turn people. It would change people's lives. In Luke 1 and 17, we already read he came in the spirit and power of Elijah. What was he doing? He was turning their hearts. He was turning the hearts of the fathers to the children. He's citing Malachi to prove that John was this expected Elijah. And you go back and read what little is in the gospel, the four gospels, about John's preaching, and you'll see that effect in his preaching, that he was turning people's hearts towards the Lord. Think of that as the end of the Old Testament. It's sort of interesting to me. The Old Testament ends with this powerful insistence that there's another prophet coming, and he'll be right before the Messiah, the messenger of the covenant. And he's coming with a fiery message that's going to separate the good people from the bad. And then 400 years of nothing. 400 years of silence as earth waited for realization of the promise. He had to come sometime during the time of that second temple prior to 70 AD. And you don't have to study much before you conclude it had to be Jesus. In the book of Acts chapter 13 verse 27, they that dwell at Jerusalem and their rulers, because they knew him not, nor yet the voices of the prophets which are read every Sabbath day, they have fulfilled them in condemning him. They didn't know the voice of the prophets. They rejected the voice of the prophets by rejecting the Son of God. Let's not make that same mistake. Let's hold fast to our conviction that Jesus is the promised Messiah. Let's embrace the fiery preaching of those morals that John talked about, that Jesus talked about, that separates the people that'll follow God from the people that won't. We could reject the voice of Malachi by rejecting Jesus, or we could also reject him by rejecting these morals that were taught that was to separate the good from the bad. We need to think about these things as we think about our relationship with God. I hope it impresses your mind. It certainly impresses my mind what a powerful affirmation that Malachi offers that Jesus of Nazareth is the Son of God. He had to be the Messiah because of the timing of when he came, because of the things that he did. And I hope that you don't have any doubts of that. If you have never named the name of Christ in your personal life and you're obeying the gospel, we want to give you the opportunity to do that. Or if you're a Christian, you need the church to pray for you, to help you in your walk with the Lord. We want to help you with that. If we can help you in either way, won't you come? Please have a seat on the front pew while we stand and while we sing.